Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Wives and Knives.
Yes, hello everybody.
Hope you're all keeping well out there. We'll start with a little catch-up and then go on to a episode of two mini cases for you.
Yes, we will.
So how have you been, Kelly?
Yeah, I've been okay, thanks. Just super busy. My little girl's had her operation now, so I've been a nursemaid for the past couple of weeks. So yeah, apologies, been a little bit absent and quiet, but we've just been fucking busy.
Yeah.
Not much going on in my life apart from that, really, just being a nursemaid.
I too have been busy. I've been really poorly. Thought it was COVID. I was so convinced it was COVID. But maybe I've just forgotten that other sort of bugs and things exist. But I've been super poorly, but defo on the mend now. Busy doing nice things as well. So yeah, life happens, doesn't it?
And absolutely.
In that vein, we've actually had some contact from someone who listened to our podcast. Kelly, will you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, we got a lovely message on the Insta, as the kids say, from Courtney Vernon, who is the daughter of Damien Vernon, who you covered quite a while ago.
Yeah.
So it's just really nice. We had really positive feedback about that episode and a lot of thanks for covering like a lesser known case.
Yeah, it particularly stood out to me and I wanted to cover it because it did seem that the coverage of the case just abruptly stopped, but there was no resolution. So I think we shouldn't stop talking about people that have gone missing just because time has passed.
Yeah, and I think we're really good for that, to be fair. You know, pat on the back for us. Because, no, but we do, it's not always the big cases that everyone's heard about, which get, you know, maybe over exposed, you know. So it's the smaller ones that people haven't heard of, and like we say, raising awareness, which I think is great. So
yeah, it's definitely good to touch on cases like that from time to time, even though there might not be as much information out there.
Absolutely.
Which is why we do these mini episodes where we just cover a few cases.
So yeah, big compliment from Courtney.
Yeah, that was
lovely to hear from her, and lovely to hear that she's doing well considering.
Yeah. Saying that about mini episodes, I have called today a mini, but I think neither of the sort of cases and topics we're going to be discussing are mini.
No, definitely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like we make them a little bit more concise, perhaps.
Yeah, it's not like mini in
not
theme.
No, and not in nor in importance either.
No, not at all. For instance, what I'm covering, there is so much information, almost too much out there, like it's contradictory, a lot of the information, but nevertheless super interesting. And is it a crime or is it a tragic accident? I will let you guys make up your mind, but I'm going to be talking about Hannah Up. So Hannah Up has been missing since the 14th of September 2017. She was born on the 29th of November, 1984. When she went missing, she was 5'7" with light brown hair and light brown eyes, and she vanished from the Virgin Islands. So I'm going to start with a little bit just about Hannah to get to know her, and then I will go into what makes this case super interesting. So, Hannah grew up in Oregon, and she was the daughter of two Methodist ministers. So, quite a religious upbringing. She grew up in the Japanese American churches in Oregon, and her parents served as pastors. Her mother, Barbara, spoke fluent Japanese and spent some time teaching in Japan. So, all throughout like Hannah's early years, they lived a... Some people describe it as like a nomadic lifestyle, and yeah, somewhat I agree. They moved around a lot, and she was exposed to loads of different cultures, but yeah, moving a lot. Her parents got divorced when she was 15, and her father then moved abroad to spread the gospel. So he traveled to India, Guam, Malta, and like loads of other places. And Hannah would quite regularly sort of go with him on these expeditions. He actually decides to settle in the Philippines, and he is very religious, like super strict religious. And he has very strong beliefs about like sexuality, and he deems homosexuality as unnatural. And this doesn't sit well with Hannah, because as she grows up, she realizes that she wants to date women, and she has to sort of hide this part of herself from her father. So this kind of leads to her seeing him less and less. She does try to see him about once a year, and there's still like some form of relationship, but seems to be a lot closer to her mother. So she graduates from the Pennsylvania Seven Sisters School in 2007, and she moves to New York City. She's working as a teacher. She also volunteers for various organizations, a lot of volunteering for an AIDS organization. She does that, and she's studying for a master's. She's super interested in other cultures, partially due to her upbringing, you would guess, but she visits Ghana, Japan, Puerto Rico, Poland, like she's very well traveled. At 23, she becomes a public school teacher in Harlem, in New York, at a place called, I hope I'm pronouncing this right again, Thurgood Marshall Academy. And she is described by everybody there as like bright, funny, outgoing, like they love her, they think she's fantastic. So, I did say that Hannah went missing in 2017, but what makes this case baffling and what has brought so much attention to it is that wasn't the first time that Hannah went missing. The first time Hannah went missing was September 2008. So at that time she was just 23 years old. And it was the first day of teaching a new job in New York, and she didn't show up. So her roommate, who she was living with at the time, had said bye to her, and then she had disappeared. She never showed up at the school. Her roommate realised that she hadn't actually taken like her wallet, her ID, a Metro card, like anything like that with her. So it almost seems as if she wasn't intending on going about her usual day anyway. But straight away, people are alarmed, like, this isn't like Hannah. There is flyers, thousands of flyers printed out and put up all over New York City. It's all over, like, the media, and the police jump on it as well, like, not usual behaviour for her. So New York is flooded with pictures of Hannah. Then, 9 days later, a guy who went to school with Hannah, like back in high school, sees her in an Apple store in the center of New York, and he's like, I'm sure that's that girl that everyone's looking for. Like, I went to school with her, I recognize her. And he goes up to her and he's like, Hannah, you're the missing teacher that everyone's looking for. And she is just like, No, I'm not, and kind of brushes him off. But he's like, I'm so sure it's her. So he calls the police, and the police managed to get CCTV of this incident and this lady that they believe to be Hannah in the store, and they call Barbara, Hannah's mum. She comes and looks at it and she's like, that is definitely Hannah. It's 100% Hannah. So please do a bit more digging. And it was Hannah. Hannah logged into her Gmail account in the Apple store and just sort of stared at the screen for a few seconds and then left. But why did she say that she wasn't her, and why is she not coming forward? Like, no one really knew the answer to that. So they start sort of tracking her, but they're always a few steps behind. So they find her on CCTV in Starbucks, find her going into a gym, and she's been living this life, moving around New York, but they still can't find her. And it's actually 20 days after she's gone missing that they find her, and the circumstances in which they find her are horrible. She is floating face down in the water, and she's discovered by the captain of the Staten Island ferry. So she's just bobbing along, and they just think that she's dead. So they try to like haul her out of the water, but when they grab her ankle, she gasps for air. And they're so shocked because they just assume that she'd be dead, just bobbing around. Anyway, they pull her out of the water, they take her to hospital, and she doesn't know what's going on. She's unable to give them her name or anything like that. And she's severely dehydrated, hypothermic, she's covered in sunburn. But other than that, she is okay. And after a while, she starts to remember her name, and she identifies herself as Hannah. And they do loads of sort of psychological assessments into what they think's happened from her. And they diagnose her with dissociative fugue, which is normally brought on by extreme psychological trauma. And it's the same form of amnesia that's in like the Bourne Identity films. I didn't know that. Of course, I've never watched that film because I've never watched anything. But it seems to be characterised by people forgetting who they are and wandering. Like, they seem to always travel during this. It's often referred to as like an offshoot from DID, which is dissociative identity disorder. But it's characterised by travelling and moving around and feeling the urge to like go somewhere, that kind of thing. But they ask Hannah like what happened before you entered this state, and she says there's no trauma, there's nothing. Her mum too is like, I don't know. So she doesn't fit all the characteristics like perfectly at all. So Hannah's eventually remembered her name, and she remembers getting ready to go to work and then deciding to go on a run. But she doesn't remember anything in between, and then she remembers being in the ambulance. When her mum actually gets to the hospital, Hannah's just sat there saying, like, why am I wet? She doesn't remember being in the water or anything. So,
wow.
Yeah, absolutely mad. So Hannah's given this diagnosis of dissociative fugue, but she's not really comfortable with that. She's like, she doesn't, because she can't remember what happened, it must obviously be like really unsettling. And she says she doesn't want this sort of illness or condition to define her, and she'll continue living her life normally, sort of as she was before, which to all intents and purposes she does. Until September 2011, when Hannah's mum, Barbara, gets a call from the police, and they're saying that Hannah has been reported missing again by her work colleagues. This time she's living in Maryland, so New York first, and then she moves and gets a new job. This is at like a Montessori school, and the ethos of the Montessori teaching really sits well with Hannah, so she's dead happy to be there. But it's the start of term, so September, like the time she went missing last time, and she's gone missing again. Like, they haven't been able to find her. but they have found her cell phone, her wallet, her keys, and they know she was seen, like, the day before she went missing. So they have, like, a small timeline, but they've no idea where she's gone, and they think it's the same thing happening over again. But the next day, so just 2 days after she's gone missing, just 3 days, maybe, I don't know the exact time is, to be honest, but Hannah receives a phone call from an unidentified number. She picks it up and she just hears Hannah on the end of the phone. She's like, she says, "Mom." So she tells her where she is, and like she manages to get to Hannah, and she is actually like quite a distance from where she went missing, and she's sitting by a creek next to a shopping cart, and she doesn't know how all this happened. So Hannah had woken up from this state, come round, realised she was by the water with the shopping cart, and she'd managed to collar a stranger and ask to borrow their phone, and that's when she'd called her mum. So obviously this isn't quite as dramatic and harrowing and as lengthy in span as the first instance where she went missing, but this shows it's not like a one-off, and this dissociative fugue thing, and sort of once it's happened once, it seems like it could well happen again. It isn't like a one-off. So these disappearances have happened. She's had loads of therapy with doctors, things like that. They're really trying to get to the crux of why this keeps happening, and they're looking for trauma, but Hannah's like, no trauma, nothing, I can't think of anything. So the doctors offer to fit her with a tag?
Yeah.
Like an ankle bracelet. Yeah. But Hannah's like, no, I don't want that. Again, she doesn't want to be defined by her illness, and she doesn't want someone knowing where she always is, and so she decides against this tracker. Her mum is scared for her and wants her to set up precautions and things, but Hannah says she's fine. She's got code words with her friends where if they text her saying a certain thing, she'll reply with a certain thing, so they know she's okay and stuff, but she's she's thinking that's enough, but it doesn't seem like it is, because Hannah moves to St. Thomas, which is one of the Virgin Islands, the American Virgin Islands, and it is now 2017, and there's storms coming, hurricanes. I've got the names of them somewhere. This is going to... What are the names of the hurricanes? Come on, Kelly. It's definitely one of them's Maria. Irma and Maria. There we go. Thank you. So, September 2017, there's been big warnings that these hurricanes are due. Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, and that they're going to trash the island. So there's loads of, big ferries and cruise ships taking people away from the islands, but not everyone wants to leave, and Hannah's one of those. She's like, it's fine, I'll bunker down here, I'll help shut up the school, I'm not bothered about leaving. So loads of people are packing up to get the fuck off the island, and Hannah hasn't told her friends on the Virgin Islands about her condition, or at least not all of them, because many do notice that she's a little bit off, she doesn't seem her usual self, but they put it down to the stress of the hurricane and what they're having to do and stuff like that. But she was noticed to be a little off, and 6 days before her disappearance, she actually stopped using her phone and just seemed to be living on autopilot. So people have said was she transitioning into this fugue state for some time beforehand. However, on September the 14th, Hannah's roommate, who is still there on the islands with her, sees her getting up and going to work, but she never does. yeah, sorry. They decide to start looking for her in all the places she usually goes, but this storm's already impacted the island and there's debris everywhere. Like, it must have been a really traumatic, people are fleeing the island and stuff. They go to a place called Sapphire Beach, which was one of Hannah's favourite places to swim. And the beach was an absolute disaster. So the Hurricane Irma had already hit it and it had turned the beach into a wreck. So there was just debris everywhere and there was a big deserted parking lot, but in the corner was Hannah's car. And inside the car was her purse, her passport, her ID, and loads of money, cash money, particularly a lot. And then along the beach was a place that used to be a bar, but was now deserted because of the storm. And her clothes and sandals and car keys were on a stool at this bar. So by the time they found all this, she'd already been missing for 2 days. And from all appearances, it looked as if she'd gone for a swim like she normally would. But why would you during this hurricane unless you weren't in the correct frame of mind? But there was no sign of Hannah, and they started sort of sending out crews to look for her. But as you can imagine, the next hurricane is due to hit and there's boats coming back and forth, taking people off the islands. Like, it's chaos. And sadly, and almost inevitably, they can't find her in the midst of all this going on. And Hannah has never been found since. She's never been seen since. And her parents, particularly her mum, has never given up hope that maybe she boarded one of the boats taking people on and off the island and she managed to escape and go somewhere else. But because of this condition that she's got, she doesn't know that. She doesn't know who she is. Sadly, a body did wash up a year later, but it was just skeletal remains and very small amounts of skeletal remains. And the word is that they've not been able to get a DNA sample from this, which I found very surprising because you find hundreds of years old bones and they can still find out some information from them. But the police on the Virgin Islands don't seem to have a very good reputation for acting on things either, so I don't know if that plays into it. But basically, this body, they can't say that it was Hannah. It's no more likely to be Hannah than anyone else that may have ended up in the sea. Yeah, the case looking for Hannah is still very much open. Obviously, the 2 times she went missing and was found again, she was found near water, and this time she's gone missing near water again. There's a lot of psychological stuff to do with people finding water calming in a stressed state. So whether she's drawn towards it because of that, there's lots of theories on YouTube in particular of people talking about the fact that this is quite this state is often brought on by trauma, and whether it was quite accurate when Hannah and her mum were saying there was no trauma, whether there was more trauma in her life than she ever let on, whether she was repressing it, who knows. But the search still continues for Hannah, and those that loved her, which there was shit tons of people, she was very much loved, want to know answers of what happened that day. And that is the case of Hannah Rupp.
Wow, it's fascinating.
Yeah. If you are into sort of psychology, there's a lot of very interesting YouTubes from psychologists who have some accreditation behind their name, not just me waffling out, talking about dissociative fugue and what brings it on and the severity of it, or the, I don't say lack of severity, but how more people have probably experienced it than are actually diagnosed, how it's misdiagnosed a lot of the time. And then some people saying it doesn't exist. And it's just interesting to hear different points of view on things like this.
Definitely.
And I've really enjoyed researching it, although obviously whatever has happened to Hannah is painfully sad. I have enjoyed learning more things about different identity disorders, and it's something that I'd like to continue looking into. And there we go, Kelly. I know you'd heard a little bit about it anyway.
Yeah, but it's nonetheless fascinating to hear all the ins and outs.
There's some cases of people who suffer with this this disorder. I don't know whether disorder is the politically correct way to call it, I'm afraid. But this diagnosis, who have gone and started completely new lives with a different identity and set up businesses before they've come out of this state and realised that's not who they are.
Yeah, I mean, Hannah could be somewhere, couldn't she?
Yeah.
You know, that's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, it's just not definitely knowing that
who she is, if that makes sense, you know.
Yeah. The only thing that I read that I was like, oh my God, with people like talking about dissociative fugue, and I was like, oh my God, yeah. You know when you drive somewhere and you don't know how you've got there?
You say that quite a lot.
Yeah, I do it all the time. And people were trying to describe what it's like, and they're like, people who've had it happen to them, like, it feels like a second has gone by, but you find out it's been days. There was a Reddit thread I was reading, and a lady who actually suffers from it, she said that she was at work on Friday and then she was at work on Monday, and she had no idea what she'd done over the weekend. And loads of people were like, yeah, same. And I was like, no, it's not that. She was laughing as well. She was like, yeah, it sounds ridiculous. But she has gone down the route of having trackers. She's got cameras in her home and stuff because she wants to know what she's been doing. And quite often, it seems to be the case with people who suffer from this, you just carry on your normal life. But you just don't know exactly who you are anymore. But she'd done all the normal things she'd do at a weekend.
Wow.
So.
I think the brain's, like, so amazing how it sort of regulates itself and, like, implements coping measures sometimes. Yeah. You know, like,
compartmentalises. Yeah.
But to such a degree that you don't know what you've done.
Yeah.
Like, that's just fascinating.
Well, there we go.
There we go, indeed.
And what are you covering this week, Kelly?
So for my case this week, I went a bit political. And as we were, like, supposed to be recording this last week, it's not as relevant, but it's still a big deal. But I'm sure you'll be aware, and I'm sure all of our listeners will be aware of what's been going on in America recently with regard to reproductive rights. So America have just gone back in time quite a number of decades with the recent decision to overturn Roe versus Wade in terms of, yeah. So, yeah, the US Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 ruling Roe versus Wade, which recognised, like, women's rights to an abortion and legalised it across the country, pretty much. So it's, I'm sure everyone's got different opinions. Like, how do you feel about abortion?
I've never had one, but there's times in my life where if I had become pregnant, then it would have been the route that I had taken. And I think everyone should have the right to make the decision of what's best for them at that particular time in their life.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think abortions should be used sort of...
as a form of contraception.
No, definitely not.
But I don't think people are, like, generally using it as that.
No, I just think... I think it should be available as an option to everybody. And I think when sort of laws become aligned with religion, that's an issue. Because if you don't sort of subscribe to that religion, why should you be... you know, like, why should you have to follow the rules, you know, linked to said religion? I just think it's not going to get rid of abortions. It's just going to take it back 50 odd years to make it so dangerous. And I just think it's ridiculous, but, you know, trust America to be a bag of dicks. But yeah, I think as well, like abortion rules in Ireland as well are not as straightforward as people think.
No,
I think,
not at all. I know a lot of people travel to the UK.
Exactly.
To be able to have an abortion because it's too difficult in Ireland.
Exactly. And, you know, again, like we've just said, it's just going to push abortions underground and like they used to be and make it really unsafe for people. Like I said, this topic is, I guess, oversaturating social media at the moment. There's so many, you know, so many people talking about it, giving their opinions. I feel like I said this for the deck, I feel like I can see like a resistance forming, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like modern rebels coming together to fight the patriarchal system. Like, I think it's amazing in a way, but it's disgusting that we have to be like this, you know. So it actually got me thinking about a small group of people that I had read about before, and there's a new documentary out about them. So I thought, okay, it's not our usual topic for true crime, but it is true crime. It got me thinking about a group called the Janes. Have you ever heard of them?
No, not at all.
So it's a network of women that basically came together in the mid-60s, and they came up with this like amazing network of people, or this network that would help people before Roe versus Wade came into law. So when abortions were illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So it started off with a student called Heather Booth, who was advocating for women's rights at the University of Chicago in 1965. And a friend of hers came to her and basically explained a situation where his sister was pregnant and was pretty much considering killing herself. So this friend, his sister who was pregnant and was very nearly thinking about unaliving herself, she, you know, she wasn't ready to have a child. She was ill-equipped to have a child. And she was actually looking for like an underground doctor to help her have an abortion. So Heather started asking around her contacts, like within the civil rights movement. And she heard of like a doctor who would possibly be able to help them. So soon word like quietly spread around the university, and they ended up sort of referring other women who were in the similar situation to this doctor. Actually recruited 10 other women to help her, and from this they actually established the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, and from that the Janes were born. So like the Jane Collective. Now the group, like, they were quite pro about this, like they, you know, like were really in on it, and they actually ran an ad in the underground paper, and they put up posters around Chicago, and all it said, this poster was, pregnant ? Don't want to be ? Call Jane. So they established like a very slick system, and it was like a two-part system, the front and the place. So the front operated out of like a house, and the front, pregnant women would be provided with counselling, you know, about what was going to happen and, you know, what they could do to help them. And then after they'd been to the front, they would travel to an apartment, which was called the place. And here is where the actual abortion would be performed. Right. So in 1970, New York State legalized abortion, which, you know, drastically changed like the situation for the Janes.
Mm-hmm.
They were still needed, but not as much.
Yeah.
But what actually came from this was that they still were very much needed, but it was more by women of colour, people who didn't have as much money, because obviously the wealthy white women could now go and get their abortions legally.
Mm.
I find it quite fascinating, like within this group of the Janes, they were actually people who weren't sort of like medically qualified, but they had trained to a level where they could actually do the abortions themselves. Wow. So it wasn't just like the doctors. It was like just these regular women who had done courses, like underground courses so that they could perform these illegal abortions.
That's scary.
Absolutely terrifying. But like I say, you know, an amazing service as well, but so sad that they had to, that yeah. was actually needed.
That was all that was available.
Absolutely. Now, the Janes carried on doing their good work until 1972. And on May the 3rd, they were still, you know, doing their usual going, like picking up these women, taking them to the front and then taking them to the place. But on this particular day, somebody had actually gone to the police station and they'd actually just dobbed them all in. So they were arrested. So 7 women were arrested and charged with 11 counts of abortion and conspiracy to commit abortion. And that meant that they were facing a maximum prison sentence of 110 years.
Oh my God.
They actually managed to hire an attorney, and it was a female attorney called Joanne Wolfson. And she was actually able to delay court proceedings because at this point, the ruling for Roe versus Wade was like happening. Mm. It was being pushed through, but it wasn't going through, like it hadn't gone through at that time. So they were still looking like they might go away for a long time. But thankfully, their solicitor, their attorney, managed to sort of delay it enough so that the ruling came in. So they didn't, they basically got away with it.
Yeah.
They didn't go to prison. But throughout all that time, the collective's goal, like to provide safe and affordable abortions, had worked, and it was now law. So all their good work had paid off effectively. Yeah. They'd saved hundreds and thousands of women through doing this, which I just think is amazing. Mm. The Janes all kept in touch. They kept in touch with their patients. They kept in touch with each other. You know, like it was a really lovely network, if that makes, you know, yeah. that sounds right. But something that I read and following, like watching this documentary, was that one of the Janes, like she was recounting an incident and what had happened. And basically a pregnant woman had arrived with them and she'd actually got an infection. And she ended up going to like the local hospital. And the local hospital at the time had like a designated septic abortion ward. So basically, like the hospitals knew, the government knew that all these unsafe abortions were going forward, to the point where they had to have like a specific ward to deal with people getting infections from dodgy backstreet abortions. You know, but still
nothing,
you know, and people regularly died there.
Mm.
Like it was, you were more likely to die from an unsafe backstreet abortion than you were, you know, from like an abortion that the Janes had done for you.
Yeah.
So, and this ward was like regularly full to burst in, you know, like with women who were experiencing life threatening, like complications from botched procedures, which I just think is disgusting.
Yeah.
And I think is more than likely what's going to happen now.
Yeah.
Like I can't imagine, I mean, I can, but I, you know, I have no sort of basis to relate this to, but I can't imagine being in a situation where you're so, like, you're so terrified of having a child that you're willing to risk your life not to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just think, I can't believe that, like, we're back there. And I know we're not in America, but it will impact on us.
Yeah.
It's already, you can already see that things are changing. And that's not something that I like want to be around. Like I just, it's just disgusting. So from watching this documentary and doing a bit more research, like I've sort of seen that there is already on Reddit and what they call an anti-network. And this is like a group of women today that are already providing assistance, shelter, and like resources to pregnant people.
About, like, because like there's different parts of America have different rules. Of course, obviously, there's people providing like places for people to live if they want to cross a particular border. Into
exactly. Come on a camping trip and stay with me. I've got a spare room.
Yeah,
that type of thing, and I just think that is amazing. Like, and these women are also, well, not just women obviously, but these activists are helping like inform women about like, how they can get access to abortion pills, how they can avoid leaving digital footprints, you know, that later might be used to indict them in America. So I've got a quote here from one of the Janes. Oh, as it coincides with my belly rumbling. And it basically says, of their experience coming through the service transformed other women, and that was our intent. We were building a new world, and that the foundations of that vision have been so systematically and methodically demolished shifts the burden to a new generation to try to save the lives and choices of women. And I just thought that really kind of sums it up. It's a really good documentary. It's streaming at the moment on Binge, but if anyone struggles, anyone wants to watch it and struggles to, then just drop me an email and I'll point you in the right direction of how to watch it. But I was discussing like the new rules around abortion and things like that with my mum, and she reminded me, like, she had told me this before but in not in as much detail, about my great-grandma, Agnes Rignall. Now there is an article about this, it's in the Lancashire Evening Post because it was quite a big deal at the time. But basically, Agnes was married, she had three children, and her husband was killed in the First World War, so 1918, I believe, like that was like, I think the day before armistice, stood up to give orders and was shot. So Agnes finds herself a widow with three children, and she ends up like living with two spinster aunts in Wigan. And she, you know, is doing her best, and she is a religious woman and she regularly goes to church, and when she's at church she actually meets a new person, like a new guy, and they start a relationship and she falls pregnant. So these two spinster aunts are like, you're a widow, it's, you know, it's not the done thing, you need to get rid of this baby. And obviously abortions were not common, you know, and but if they were common, they were regularly done in the like a backstreet abortion. So Agnes went and had a backstreet abortion. A woman like did it for her. Now, sadly, she got an infection following the procedure and she died in hospital a few days later. And the woman that had actually performed the abortion was arrested and sent to prison for the rest of her life.
Wow.
All because these two spinster aunts didn't want the aggravation or the tarnish on their name. You know, why didn't they just get married? You know, like, or maybe Agnes didn't want to have the child, and that wasn't like, you know, that wouldn't have been the resolution to the situation for her. I don't know, but at the end of the day, that's like three children growing up with no parents for the sake of one more child in the family. I just think it's so sad, you know, and I worry that, like I say, that's, you know, like, let's call it 1920. But this is actually going to be a problem that presents itself for people in 2022. Like, that just blows my mind. We are going backwards. It's just shocking. So, yeah. So, like I said, not our usual for that one, but I just felt like I really, when I watched that documentary and I've been so angry reading everything that's been going on, I just thought, I'm going to talk about that today. And I did. Good. So there.
Yeah, it's shocking. And like you said, it is going back in time. That documentary sounds really interesting, and I will do some googling about the Janes, because they sound like an incredible bunch of women.
Of course, and they won't have been the only sort of collective group of people who were doing that. There would have been loads of different little pockets of people doing the same all around the country, which I find amazing. But what I don't find amazing is that's happening now.
Yeah, and
we shouldn't need to.
The dangers that come with that.
Absolutely. And I've been catching up on The Handmaid's Tale as well. Yeah. And I'm just like, I'm watching it now with a different eye, under his eye. Because I'm like, it's not far away from reality.
It's not so far removed that it's comfortable anymore.
No, yeah. And I'm watching it, and I'm just like, and I'm very uncomfortable. Mm. It's not cool. Not cool at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's it from me this week. I guess we'll be back next week with something a little bit more weightier, maybe. Something to get your teeth into. But we'll see. I guess I have to apologise in advance because there has been a death in the family. My iPad's died.
Yeah.
So not quite sure how I'm going to get this edited and everything, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
So until then, stay safe, take care, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.